Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Over the past decade, more than 150 million trees in California's forests have died, and that has raised many concerns. As carbon dioxide levels continue to rise, wildfires grow in intensity and frequency, and the climate crisis alters ecosystems, what does the future hold for forests, and which trees will survive? In his new book, The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future, today's guest, journalist Zach St. George, explores the evolving movements of forests by focusing on five trees, the giant sequoia, ash, black spruce, Monterey pine, and Florida torreya. He visited forests across continents, finding sequoias losing their needles in California, fossil records showing the paths of ancient forests in Alaska, and domesticated pines in New Zealand. What is being done to protect our forests and trees? What actually works, and what will ensure they are here for future generations? Zach St. George is a science reporter who has written for The Atlantic, Outside Magazine, and other publications, and his new book is The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. Hi, Zach. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Congratulations on your book. You write about so many aspects of trees, about the climate crisis, about what it means when people try to move trees. You write about how human activities have shaped the life of a tree. You say that some years ago you encountered the idea of trees being in the wrong places and thought it was such a strange and fantastic idea and very, very important. So what really sparked the idea to write this book?
Sure. In 2014, I heard a story about a timber company in California, Sierra Pacific Industries, planting giant sequoias north and upslope of the tree's natural range. And it was just kind of in passing reference in a New York Times article. And I thought it was really strange and interesting. I wondered why the company was doing that. So I ended up writing a long article about that program. And it seemed like there was a lot of questions that I still had at the end of that. I was interested in kind of the symbolic meaning that people attach to trees. I was it kind of opened me to the idea that, you know, climate change will cause many species, all species, to change their distribution. And we can already see that with, you know, very mobile things like fish and birds and mammals. But trees do it too. And I thought that was kind of interesting because, as anyone who's been around a tree knows, individual trees don't move much. So it's a different kind of movement. It's tree by tree. It's multi-generational. And I thought that, you know, it's a big story. These trees cover a third of the land on Earth. They're home to countless other species. People depend on them for food, fuel, shelter. So if you have lots of forests shifting and changing, that has the potential to be really disruptive. And then the final thing is just that people are really attached to trees in a way that they aren't to other plants or even most animals. Trees are big, they live a long time. We like having them around. So they take on all this symbolic meaning. So I was interested in taking this kind of symbol of steadiness and longevity and recasting it as something in motion.
As you said, trees cover a third of land on Earth. And you write, forests are home to millions of species. So a story about trees says so much about living things in general.
Right. I mean, I think, when you look at diversity of species, at least on land, much of it is concentrated in forests. You look at the tropical forests are home to huge amounts of diversity. But even in temperate regions like California, trees form kind of the basis for many ecosystems.
we've done a lot of shows about fires in California, about the climate crisis and how it's affecting trees. You spoke to a number of scientists and people who work at national parks just about what they're seeing. I mean, a lot of people said, you know, we've never seen anything like this. We're not really sure where this is going. What struck you the most about what you heard specifically about how the climate crisis is affecting trees?
Yeah, I think in California, we've, as you mentioned, there's been 150 million trees that died during the drought from 2012 to 2015. And yeah, it is unprecedented in our lifetime in the historical record. Speaking with paleoecologists, people who study past periods of climate change, they say this is something, you know, this is kind of a standard thing that you see during periods of climate change, particularly when you're leaving a period of relative climatic steadiness, like we've experienced for really the extent of human kind of agricultural civilization over the last 10,000 years. So when you leave a period of steadiness and go into a period of rapid change, you do see lots of fires. You see kind of these effects of drought. You see dead trees. And really, you can think about it as sort of a mismatch between where trees sprouted and where they're living now. And so that makes them vulnerable to drought, makes them vulnerable to insects. You know, in California, there are some confounding factors. As your guests last week, Alistair Gee and Danny Anguiano described, there's a lot of confounding factors with a century of fire suppression. But kind of generally, we do see lots of fires and lots of insect outbreaks during periods of change.
Right. And as people told you, warmer temperatures will likely bring even more fires. You write, as I write this in the summer of 2019, sensors on Mauna Loa on the Big Island of Hawaii have measured the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide at 414 parts per million, up from 280 parts per million just before the Industrial Revolution. The last time the concentration was this high was about 3 or 4 million years ago. And recently, a group of scientists estimated that by the middle of this century, we will reach a carbon dioxide concentration not seen since about 55 million years ago. So it seems like, I mean, I think about all the shows we've done. It's just that things are moving so quickly and changing so quickly.
Yeah, it's moving very quickly. I don't think we have a lot of analogs, which, you know, paleoecologists often look for analogs. So what periods of change in the past look like what we're going through in the present? There aren't a lot, at least in any recent periods. You know, at the end of the last ice age, about 11,700 years ago, I think is when it officially ended. But, you know, at the end of the ice age, it changed fairly rapidly. My understanding is it was not as rapid as this. And of course it's did not continue to change, which I think we have, currently no reason to think that, the change will kind of stop at some, point in the future, unless we change our habits.
It was very interesting to read about how scientists study trees and to learn more about the importance of tree plotting. You write, a forest is a complicated, restless thing with trees dying and sprouting in every direction. A forester trying to grasp what is happening will most often start the investigation by staking out a plot. They use this small patch of trees as a key to the surrounding forest. So tell us what you learned about the plots that are being studied at Sequoia National Forest. This is a Sequoia National Park. This is set high in the Sierra Nevada of Eastern California. This is where giant sequoias grow, the world's biggest trees, the oldest and tallest. It's just so beautiful. if you haven't been yet, it really is an amazing experience. You report that 30,000 or so trees grow in 30 plots scattered. Every tree is tagged and measured, and if a tree has died, the team gives it an autopsy. Tell us more about how scientists put these plots together and how they study them.
Yeah, so this is a pretty amazing project they have going in Sequoia National Park, and it's I think really a testament to the value of funding science and particularly long-term funding of science. In the 80s, this group of researchers with the U.S. Geological Service staked out a bunch of plots. So I'm not fresh on the details of how big these plots are, but basically they took a certain amount of space, maybe 100 feet to a side, and measured every single tree inside those plots. And I think there was 30 of them today. So they measured every tree, they identified it, they noted its condition, I think they took cores from some of the trees, so you can take cores and, of course, count the rings and age trees. And they put tags on them so they'd be able to come back and identify them. And then that's what they did every year after. For the last 30 years, they've gone back and done the same thing. They visited the same trees. There's now 30,000 of them. And so what that allows you to do is really gain a long-term perspective of change. You can see how, tree composition might change. So maybe pines become more prevalent. Maybe, incense cedars are dying out. You can look at growth rate. You can look at kind of the overall health of the forest. And they found some interesting things. Some alarming things, especially. One is that sugar pines, which are the biggest species of pine and really beautiful, magnificent trees, during the drought, most of the big sugar pines died, mostly killed off by beetles. And these are trees that ordinarily could live 500 years. So in the matter of 5 years, most of them died. And another thing, it's just more generally, they've been able to look at kind of the causes of mortality during the drought. So we mentioned the 150 million dead trees. In these plots, among these 30,000 trees, they could really get a fine-grained look at what was killing different species of trees and at what point in the drought.
You joined a group of U.S. geological scientists on a hike in Sequoia National Park in October 2014, 3 years into a statewide drought. One of the scientists you spoke with said he hadn't seen anything like it in his four decades at the park. As the sequoias lost their needles, as the foliage turned brown and fell away in clumps, there were no records of anybody else seeing it before. Reporters have been calling from around the world asking why the sequoias were dying, and he wasn't sure what to tell them. What else did you learn from him? I believe his name was Stevenson, but it looks like his name dropped off. The first name dropped off of our notes. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's Nate Stevenson.
Nate, thank you.
He's been at USGS there in the park for many years. He is probably among the top two or three experts on sequoias in the world right now. He's been there for 30 years, or I guess almost 40 rather. He had never seen sequoias lose their needles in big clumps, which is what was happening. They were turning brown. It had snowed the day before I was there, so the ground was just covered in these kind of golden brown sequoia needles. Nate Stevenson had not seen it. He looked through records, hadn't seen it. There was a lot of worry at that point that the sequoias were just, the old sequoias even, were just going to start dying and we were going to lose them, in a matter of years. That hasn't turned out to be the case. Few of the sequoias died. Most survived. But it has provided a potential preview of the future if we keep getting long, hot droughts in California. And so really what the scientists are working on now is trying to understand kind of the mechanisms of why did these ancient beloved trees lose their needles all of a sudden. Is this just a standard defensive mechanism that they have to deal with drought, or is this kind of a sign of desperation? But it's also really helped them understand kind of why the sequoias are where they live, which is a fairly narrow, rare set of circumstances in the Sierra Nevada of Eastern California.
Tell us more about what you learned about needles and about how the needles help the trees survive. As you write, in the winter of 2012, little snow fell in the Sierra Nevada and even less the winter after. The next year, 2014, was California's driest year in at least a century. That summer, the sequoias began losing their needles. To a sequoia researcher, it was fascinating, but it also made Nate Stevenson very nervous.
Yeah, so, you know, the needles or the leaves in other types of trees is where photosynthesis happens. It's where the tree gets its energy and converts sunlight and water, carbon dioxide to sugars. So yeah, when they start losing a bunch of needles, it's not a great sign for the plant. And so what they think happened basically is leaves transpire water. So trees are like big pumps, and they use evaporation to pull water up through the roots, and it goes up into the canopy where the needles and leaves are, and that powers photosynthesis. And so they think that when these trees lost their needles, it was reducing the amount of water they needed to supply the needles, because many plants can't really shut off how much water they're using ordinarily. So they think it was kind of a defensive mechanism, and it remains a little unclear how bad a sign that was that they were losing their needles. So there's still a lot we don't really know.
Today we are speaking with science reporter Zach St. George about his new book, The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. Zach explores the evolving movements of forests by focusing on giant sequoias, ash, black spruce, Monterey pine, and Florida Torreya. Is that how you say it, Zach? Torreya?
Yeah, so there's a couple options. One is Torreya and one is Torreya. And it's a regional thing. It's a tomato type of deal.
Okay. I didn't know much about the Florida Torreya until I read your book. I mean, there are so many. You go really deep into these five trees. I want to give out the phone number. If any of you would like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. I know that so many of our listeners, they love trees. They love to spend time outside. What changes have you seen in some of your favorite places? And if you're working on saving trees, we would love to hear from you. The other interesting thing that we learned in Zach's book is there is a right way and a wrong way to plant trees. And we're learning a lot about what happens when people actually move trees. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. You talked a little bit about water and how the drought is affecting trees. What else did you learn about how the drought affects sequoias and how it's just fascinating to learn about how trees take in water? It's such an amazing an amazing visual.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the questions with giant sequoias more than a century, European Americans discovered or realized the existence of giant sequoias in the 1850s. Native peoples, of course, had known about them much longer. What has always stood out about the giant sequoia groves, separating them from the surrounding forest, is the presence of groundwater. And so people have argued about that for a long time, but it currently seems, kind of the current understanding is that the groundwater is kind of what allows the sequoias to compete in those places. And so they depend a lot on melting snow from further upslope. And so there's a lot of worry that as there's less snow, as snow melts earlier in the year, rather than gradually all summer, that these little wet places where the sequoias live are going to be less wet and maybe less suitable for the trees. So there's some discussion about, what can we do about this? One idea was, well, okay, maybe we put sprinklers in the giant sequoia groves. We can water them. So that's an option. Another option, which the people at the park are currently discussing is maybe you could move them to somewhere where it's wetter and would be more suitable. So obviously you can't move the existing trees, which is, the reason for the existence of the park is because of these giant, amazing trees. So it's hard to think about, planting seeds and those seedlings being sort of the new focus of your attention. But that's kind of the difficult place we're in. As I mentioned, a timber company is actually doing this project, planting sequoias north and upslope. They call it a giant sequoia genetic conservation project. It's, the timber company says it is altruistic. They've gotten a lot of cooperation from the state and federal authorities who manage the groves. It's an experiment.
I have to say, Zach, I had to read this section of the book twice because I was thinking, okay, the Pacific Timber Company has a seed mm-hmm. bank, because we've done some shows on seed banks. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a timber company. So, I mean, we only have a minute before we go to break. We can talk about this more after the break, but who owns these seeds?
That's a good question. So, as I mentioned, the state and federal authorities kind of allowed the company to collect these seeds with the understanding that the trees that are then grown from them would not be put to commercial purposes. So the trees could then grow seeds of their own, which I think the timber company could then use. But that's, 40 years in the future.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll talk more about this seed bank that's run by the Pacific Timber Company, moving sequoias to protect them. We'll talk more about that after the break. Today, we are joined by science reporter Zach St. George. He's out with a new book, The Journey of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. And it is a fascinating book. Zach traveled to many continents to learn more about five trees: giant sequoias, ash, black spruce, Florida Torreya, and Monterey pine. And just a couple of facts about forests and trees. Trees are everywhere. They cover a third of land on Earth. They're home to millions of species. So a story about trees says much about living things in general. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Who's watching the kids? The challenge of childcare during a pandemic, the subject of 1A, 11 o'clock this morning, right after your call, 1/2 hour from now here on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about trees and forests with science reporter Zach St. George. He's out with a new book, The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. If you have any questions or comments for Zach, any stories you'd like to share about trees and forests in your area, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk more about the seed bank that was set up by the Pacific timber industry. As you report, the company reveals little about its finances, but in 2018, Forbes called Sierra Pacific's owner, Red Emerson, America's, quote, last great lumber baron, estimating his net worth at $4 billion, the company's annual profit to be in the hundreds of millions. And you report that the seed program so far cost the company something like $300,000. So what are they trying to do here exactly? Zach? Did we lose Zach? Oh, did Zach disappear? Oh, you know, it sounded like his Skype. That was his Skype. All right. We are going to reconnect with Zach. We have him on Skype. I'm in my kitchen. Kevin Vance is at the studio, and then the guests are all at their homes, and we connect to them by Skype or phone. And we are going to try to reconnect with Zach. Zach St. George is a science reporter, and his new book is The Journey of Trees, a story about forest people and the future. And I'll just read a little bit from the section about the seed bank while we try to reconnect with Zach. So this is just really interesting. And still, we want to find out how this came about and who is going to own these seeds. And Zach writes that as part of the company's agreement to collect cones on federal and state managed groves, the company has pledged not to sell the sequoias it grows from those groves as timber, but there are indirect ways it could recoup its investment. Once they're big enough, the groves could be entered into California's carbon credit market. Someday the groves could perhaps even be sold to the public as conservation easements or parks. And I believe we have Zach back. Are you back with us, Zach?
Yeah, thanks, Rose.
Okay. So I was just reading from your section about this seed bank. Can you tell us a little bit more about this and how it came to be?
Sure. So one of the vice presidents at Sierra Pacific Industries, a number of years ago, they were at a meeting of people who manage giant sequoia groves. And there's about 65 or 70, depending on how you count them. And so many of the managers were concerned that, you know, with climate change, the trees were not going to thrive. They were not long-term going to survive where they were. And so they had discussed starting a seed bank. So they'd collect cones from kind of a representative sample of trees and put them in cold storage and, you know, if the trees in the wild die off, maybe we can start new growth someday with the seeds we've collected. And so this vice president of Sierra Pacific Industries thought, well, we're already planting trees. We already collect cones. We already collect seeds. We have a ton of space. It's a privately owned company, so they didn't have to answer to shareholders or anything. And so he talked to his boss and they came up with this plan. So over the next, I think maybe 20 years, they're going to go around to each of the 70 some groves, collect cones, and then plant new groves across their holdings. I think as far north as Redding, maybe even further. And basically duplicate the existing groves. And so I think as you mentioned, yeah, it struck me as a little bit odd. Why is this company doing this? What's in it for them? And that, you know, that was my first instinct as a reporter. I guess I don't have a satisfactory answer as far as, I can't definitively say that it's not some scheme. You know, I think people who deal with trees are used to timber companies kind of being the bad guys. In this case, you know, there's plenty of people who will tell you that they must be up to no good. But the people who manage the groves don't seem to think that. They seem to think that this company is fairly sincere. For a large timber company, it's not particularly expensive to do this. So, you know, whether for good or bad, with whatever motives they're doing it, I joined for a couple of years in a row and watched as joined in as they collected cones. And and then they're over the next, you know, years, they'll be planting them all across California.
You know, because we were wondering why the state government or the federal government doesn't take on a project like this.
Yeah. We were talking about Nate Stevenson, the U.S. Geological Survey scientist in Sequoia National Park. That's something that I think he and some other people would be interested in doing, at least as kind of an experimental, as an experiment. I think it just it is a lot with budgets and kind of all of the basically paperwork and discussions that you'd have to have. So I think that may happen in the future, that sort of federal and state agencies do things like this. There are examples in other parts of the country of kind of small scale experimental movements of trees. So one place I visited was in northern New Hampshire. The Forest Service has partnered with Dartmouth in doing some small scale plots where basically they've moved species from southern New Hampshire into northern New Hampshire, just to kind of see how they'll do. So I think it will eventually happen that you see more government agencies experimenting.
Do you know how much of these forests are privatized?
In California, I think there are, of course, some pretty extensive state and national forests, particularly. But yeah, there are a lot of them are privatized, and that, of course, gives you a little more freedom to do what you want. Something you're seeing in the forestry industry already is foresters are planting seeds that they've collected from a little bit south or a little bit downslope. And that's sort of anticipating the effects of climate change, saying that maybe the species or the members of the species that are kind of adapted to a more southern or lower altitude climate will be a little better suited to the future. That's actually already mandated in British Columbia that foresters must do that. And some other Canadian provinces as well.
Well, we have a couple of questions for you, Zach, a couple of listeners who couldn't stand the line. One listener wants to know, what has fracking done to trees?
I honestly can't really speak to that. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I would assume that it must have some effect. It's if you're getting strange colored water out of your tap, that can't be something that trees really want. But on a broad scale, I'm not really sure.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I was just you didn't write about fracking in your book, but there is a story, Eco Hustler, The Effect of Fracking on Trees. If you just do a quick search, there's a couple articles about that. That'd be interesting to learn more. But thank you for the question. Another question from a listener. Can you talk more about water and just how water – well, the caller says, how does water make its way up a 300-foot sequoia tree?
That's a good question. And again, I have kind of a surface level understanding. Basically, you have transpiration from the leaves or needles, and so you get a negative pressure from this evaporation. And so that, in conjunction with surface tension, is helping water move up these really tiny straws, basically, that go all the way up. And there's been a lot of work with redwoods on kind of what is the physiologically maximum height that a tree can get to based on, the physics, I guess. And, again, my understanding is, kind of surface level, but it seems, my recollection is that redwoods, which get close to 400 feet, if not above, are kind of at the maximum height for a tree based on the mechanisms that they use and the physics involved.
Hmm. Well, thanks for the questions. If you have a question about forests, trees, any comments, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. There's so much talk about tree planting, and you have a really interesting section in your book about how tree planting really needs to be done carefully. What did you learn from scientists about that?
Well, I think everybody is probably familiar with the idea that trees soak up carbon dioxide, and thus are a good, seen as a good climate mitigation tool. And they are, and they can be. Kind of the important thing to remember is that trees are not only affecting climate change, they're affected by it. So we spoke about trees sort of being out of sync with the climate that they're suited to. So, that can happen when you're planting trees as a climate mitigation strategy. So you need to kind of plan and think about what is going to be suited to the climate in 50 years or 100 years or whatever length of time that you want these things to be soaking up carbon dioxide. The other piece is that we have many examples of trees kind of getting away and causing problems. You have calorie pear is a common horticultural planting all over the East Coast. It's an invasive species. You have paper bark in Florida. You have tamarisk in the Southwest. And there's all these examples of kind of people planting trees in the wrong places and really altering the places where they're planting them in a way that we don't really want. And then there's the piece are the trees you're planting supporting ecosystems? Do you want to support more biodiversity, or are you lowering it by planting maybe too many of the same kinds of trees? There in San Francisco, you have a long standing debate about the blue gum eucalyptus that is planted, on Mount Sutro and all over the Oakland Hills. There's a long debate over whether those trees belong, whether they support biodiversity, whether they're a fire hazard. They were planted about 100 years ago as basically a get-rich-quick scheme by kind of venture capitalist types. A lot of people like them. A lot of people don't really think they should be there. So I think we can kind of see the potential future of some tree planting campaigns in the blue gums of San Francisco and Oakland.
Yeah, to that point, we have some emails from listeners who want us to do shows about cutting trees in San Francisco. One listener writes, San Francisco's cutting hundreds of large old growth trees surrounding Lake Merced. Some of these trees are over 6 feet diameter. The lake banks are now dry, dusty trash, covered dumping areas that are left to fall into the lake, turning it into a swamp. I see coyotes, blue cranes, hawks, and other rare wildlife who use the forest around the lake as habitat, as now displaced and dying. The forest around the lake was helping to mitigate the carbon dioxide and particulate matter of the ever-increasing car and other industry pollution circling the lake. Why is this happening? So, yeah, thank you. We will definitely do a show about this. We got another very, very long email about what's happening in San Francisco, and we will look into this. Thank you for the links and do a show about this. We have another email from Alan about planting sequoias. What was growing on the grounds where the new sequoia seeds will go? It's an interesting topic.
Yeah, so it varies a little bit. Basically, the company that that is doing this, Sierra Pacific Industries, a lot of conservationists really don't like them because they do managed forestry, which is they're basically clear cutting either wholly virgin woods or woods that were already cut over once or twice. So kind of the biggest, oldest trees removed already. But basically it's a kind of farm type forestry, and they so they clear cut, you know, a couple acres, leave a few trees kind of as a visual, to dull the visual impact. And then they replant it with, their timber trees that they want to grow. So typically, pines and firs and, maybe Doug firs. So it's kind of what the company was doing already, but now they throw giant sequoias in the mix. And so as they harvest these other trees, they'll leave the giant sequoias.
We have another question from a listener. Should eucalyptus trees be cut?
I love the eucalyptus debate. Should they be cut? I mean, sometimes, probably. I think, you know, I've written a lot about the fire question. Are eucalyptus especially dangerously flammable? Basically, what I found is there's no kind of apples to apples science. So is a eucalyptus pound for pound more flammable than a bay tree? And there's not really good science on that. The thing is, eucalyptus are really big. They shed a lot. So the most convincing answer on the fire question from my perspective had to do with just the size and volume of the blue gums. Should they be cut because they're invasive or non-native? I'm doing air quotes here, but again, it's kind of an aesthetic choice. It's kind of a where you come down on the question of non-natives in general. You know, a lot of people really don't feel that anything, any plant from Australia should be, kind of growing wild in, the Bay Area. Other people say, well, they're really big trees. They smell nice. I like walking in them. And you know, that's another valid argument. So should they be cut? Maybe sometimes. I don't think that all of them should be cut.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Karen from Canyon. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
I appreciate the guest and the research that he's done. However, when there was talk earlier about questioning whether Sierra Pacific Industries is doing this out of altruism, I certainly don't buy that theory, that's why they're doing it, because SPI is it's the biggest clear cutter in California. It's one of the biggest destroyers of forests in California. And I think that when you mentioned earlier, Rose, that perhaps carbon credits in the future would be one reason, I think that hits on a very good possibility. And without getting into the fact that I believe the carbon market is a false solution, that's a whole other ball of wax. But I think that the discussion around, you know, what we can do, my opinion, and I've been a forest activist for many years, is that rather than looking to the proper kind of mitigation, what we as the human species need to do is to stop our destructive habits and practices that are causing the climate crisis and that are destroying forests, that's not the route to saving the forest. So instead of, you know, coming in thinking that we can be the saviors of the forest by moving the trees or somehow manipulating the way that they grow or where they grow, I think it's more an issue of addressing what's causing problems for the forest. I mean, you know, Mother Nature knows a heck of a lot more than any humans do in the end. And I think that we need to look to our own habits and the causes of forest destruction.
Well, thank you, Karen. And just to be clear, I was reading that section from Zach's book, When We Lost Him, so that came directly from his book. Related to Karen's call, Zach, Susan writes in about the seed bank, and she said, you know, it really makes her nervous. So what are your thoughts about Susan and Karen's concerns?
Yeah, well, thanks for the questions. I think, regarding the motives of Sierra Pacific Industries, Karen is absolutely right. They are huge clear cutters. You know, are they wholly good? Are they wholly bad? I think a company can be both. So I guess I couldn't really come to a clear conclusion on in terms of what is the point of this Sequoia genetic conservation project. Do they have ulterior motives? I couldn't really come to any firm conclusion on what, if any, motives there were beyond what they told me. So at that point, I kind of just wrote about the project without really assigning kind of those moral labels to it. I will say that the people at federal and state agencies that are involved in this project that who have basically signed off to allow it to happen are pretty widely in agreement that it's a good thing. So I think that's telling, even if I'm sure many of these people don't agree with everything that Sierra Pacific does.
Well, we should just do a show about the lumber industry because it's just so huge in California. And I think it's such a really important topic. So we will take that piece of your book and then expand it and try to really get some answers to figure out what they're doing with this seed bank and to find out, you know, what California politicians think of this, what will happen once these seeds are collected. I mean, there's so many questions around this. So thank you for the questions and we will stay on this. We have Michael couldn't stand the line. He's from Humboldt. He has a question. He says, Zach, can you tell us what is your elevator pitch? Like, what is the essential story your book is trying to tell?
Sure. It's about the future of forests, which are, like I say, cover a third of the land on Earth. When forests change, there's going to be all sorts of repercussions. And, I think we can see that with examples of sudden change, like the Paradise Fire that you were talking about last week. We can see that in even things like the maple syrup industry moving north over the last decades. So it's a big, wide story that's going to happen all around the world. The way I tackled it is really through kind of a couple stories of people sort of looking at this huge coming change and trying to do something about it. And so specifically by moving trees north, So a lot of it is kind of about sort of accepting that change is coming and trying to confront it on an individual or community level.
Well, thank you for joining us, Zach. Thanks for writing this book. It's just really important information. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Zach St. George is a science reporter who has written for The Atlantic and other publications. His new book is The Journeys of Trees, a story about forests, people, and the future. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Kevin Vance and David LaTulipe, thank you as always for keeping our studio running. And I know I said in the billboard that we were going to air some sound from Rayshard Brooks's family. We decided that it really didn't fit in today's show. I mean, what's really happening behind the scenes is we have shows booked, and unfortunately, tragically, another black man is killed by police. And behind the scenes, we are talking about whether we should change the show. And so we were going to play sound from Rayshard Brooks's family. We decided to wait until tomorrow, because on tomorrow's show, we are going to have a panel of doctors of color on, and it just makes more sense to do it then. You can read more about what happened to Rayshard Brooks online. We will be playing sound from his family's press conference during tomorrow's show. I hope you can join us for that. And you can find more information about all of the shows that we have done around police violence and racism at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.